My name is Christian, and I'm an alcoholic. I haven't been at this thing too long. My sobriety date is May 31, 2019. I have a home group. It is Suffered Enough, which is in a little suburb of Richmond called Chesterfield, and is probably about the best name I've found a meeting to have, because I had to get there, and in order to get there, I had to suffer enough. And I've worked in recovery houses and a lot of other places that I've had to say those words to people. You're not ready yet. You haven't suffered enough. And they don't like to hear that, but it's true. I have a sponsor. He knows that he's my sponsor, which is a little bit of an advantage, because my first sponsor didn't work out very well, you know. I was actually, just go back to the beginning, how it was. I was born in the mountains. On the drive here, when we overtook a hill, it just, you know, it every time, it never fails that when I see the Blue Ridge Mountains, it just, a peace settles over me. You know, now I think I know a little bit about why that is, but I grew up in the mountains of North Georgia, actually, about 20 minutes away from where they filmed Deliverance. And, you know, the first 10 years of my life, I think, are probably my favorite memories of all time. We lived just south of the mountain, Kurgi Mountain, which is where they filmed Band of Brothers. Kurgi Mountain was my front yard, and we didn't have neighbors for about 5 miles, and I just had free reign. Could run, gun, do anything I wanted to. I had a sister, father, and a mother. My father was a fireman. He was gone what seemed like all the time. My mother worked as well, and you know, I think self-sufficiency comes to mountain folk a little earlier than most other kids. And 5 years old, you know, I'm running around the woods by myself. 7 years old, I'm running around hunting, you know, by myself. Today's society, I think, would probably end up, somebody would end up arrested. So long story short, my father was one of us, and made that ultimate sacrifice when I was 9 years old. He just couldn't take it anymore. Things obviously changed, you know, that idyllic childhood. And I saw, you know, I saw some of the chaos that alcoholism brings to a family. But I was so young, you know, that, and I think my mother shielded me from most of it. But I saw and heard a good bit of it, especially towards the end. But other than those kind of sparse memories, it was, you know, up until that point, it was just bliss for me. I just ran around the woods, riding bikes, you know, playing sports. My father was the high school baseball coach, so I was in the woods, you know, tree was my tee with a Tupperware cup. You know, and I would just stand out there for hours and hours and hours and hours swinging the baseball bat. And then suddenly, you know, everything changes. You would think that maybe I would have gotten a message there, you know, but I went on to do ultimately everything he did except pull the trigger. In some cases, a whole lot worse than he did. You know, so that happens, and a series of moves start. We move from that tiny little town in North Georgia to a tinier little town in extreme western Tennessee out by the Mississippi River. And I'm 12, 13, lived there until about 12 or 13. And we were talking on the way up here about how there wasn't much to do, you know, in the plains of West Tennessee. So there was a lot of drinking and drugs. And that's really where, you know, it started picking up. I had older siblings that partied and partied hard. One of them just last year, a year and a half ago, passed away from an alcoholic death. Very, that's never pretty, but this one was rather morbid, even in by that classification. So I had ready access. I had probably a little bit more access to drugs and alcohol than most 13-year-olds would. And I took full advantage of that, and I was selling weed in school and drinking. And when I drank, even then, it would go to extreme levels, and my friends would go home wasted from my house, So I get a reputation basically of, don't let your kids go hang out with them. Kind of keeps going. I do fine in school. I'd never get in trouble. Yeah, I'm such a people pleaser. Never fired until I got sober. And so I never had a demerit. So behavior wise, I guess putting on a good front. We move again. I think I lived there for 2 or 3 years, and we moved to Tampa, Florida, which is just, people can't even understand me because of my accent in a lot of places. And Tampa, Florida certainly wasn't one of them that they understood anything. So that was quite a culture shock. I'm 14, 15 at the time. And as a result of all these moves, I remember when I went to rehab, they had this little list of like 10 factors that if you had three of them, you were 95% more likely to be an addict or alcoholic. And there was only one that I didn't have. I had nine, and it was like I had no chance. But regardless, so we moved to Tampa. This whole time, my mother's just chasing our career, just trying to make enough money to feed the kids. And only lived there for a year and then move up to Richmond. And I'm in 10th grade in Richmond. And boy, that's when things really start getting traction when it comes to I'm just looking back at the things that I did. I can't believe that I stayed in school, much less made any kind of good grades. Drink 12 pack of beer before school sometimes, I was always a binge drinker up until 40 years old, 42 years old. I would party really hard, like wheels come off hard, like people looking at you like you're a lunatic, because I was. But then I would stop. I played football, baseball, ran track. A lot of times I would show up at football practice, especially during 2-a-days, with just reeking of vodka, but I'm, 16, 17 years old and in incredible shape, and I could do that. But I would always be able to cut it off, and that pattern consisted for quite a long time. So for the first time when I moved to Richmond, we lived in a little bit more of an affluent area. I thought that I was poor growing up, and I blamed a lot of that on my parents. I lived there, I was carrying my cross, right? Turns out that was just a bunch of crap. I didn't realize that until I worked my first real four step. That we weren't poor. We always had food. We always had shelter. We even had playthings. I've seen poor now that my eyes have been opened, and we were not poor. But I really bore that cross for quite a while. But when we moved to Richmond, we lived a little bit more fluently for the first time. Frankly, at that point, my friends were, I didn't hang out with the kind of people that I had before, which was just straight up drug addicts, those were my people. They were just a little bit more, I don't know what else to say besides, affluent. Well-to-do, making good grades was not frowned upon. Like where the people I hung out with before, the places that I lived before, and the environments I was in, if you make good grades, you got beat up, you know? But, you know, so this is the first time that I'm seeing people strive for better. And it's actually a positive attribute. It hadn't been up until then. So even though I'm, you know, a raging binge drinker, and drugs are quite a large part of my story too, I'm doing it amongst people that I guess could get away with it. You know, it was in, not encouraged, but it was overlooked. You know, I mean, you get a DUI, which I did at 17, my only DUI. I'm proud of that fact. I don't know how in the world I didn't get one after that, but I did at 17, screaming down. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Richmond, but Midlothian Turnpike going the wrong direction. So, you know, but I get taken to the police station and my mom comes against me. And, you know, that's pretty much it. Football star, baseball star, you know, no real repercussions. I was scared more of my mom than I was, you know, anything else. Not scared enough to not do stuff like that, but you know. So this kind of keeps on. I do this on again, off again thing into college, you know, do the same thing to where I just, when I party, people are taken aback. You know, they've rarely seen something like that, if ever. You know, flying out of three-story, third-story windows, trying to catch a tree limb, you know, just Tarzan and falling and breaking my ribs on a curb, jumping off the top of the rugby house, you know, just this is what I did. But then I would stop. I would go to class and I would get excellent grades and work. Always had one at least, sometimes two or three jobs. All the while, just, you know, partying like some kind of maniac. That goes all through college. And then I end up meeting the person that I'm going to marry her, and then go to law school. I have a little bit of a resentment about having to wear this suit because I'm a lawyer and I got to wear this crap all the time. So when y'all told me I had to wear this, I was a little bit taken aback, but I worked through it. I can do that now, right? So go to law school and literally do the same thing. But, you know, I actually dial it back there to a degree. But I still find people that will party with me and party like me, at least approaching like me. I think I've only ever met one person in my whole life that drank and drugged like I did. And I married her. Still married to her. She was sober, obviously, when I did that. But I would, you know, study like crazy, like crazy, like crazy, party like crazy, but able to cut it off, cut it off, cut it off. Graduate law school, move up to Richmond, start practicing law, have a couple of kids. Same pattern, you know, always able to work for the first 15, you know, 20 years, making a complete jackass out of myself on a lot of occasions, you know, family functions. My mentor and boss used to come to me, and if we were going to some bar dinner or something like that, he would specifically pull me aside and say, "This is one of those things that we, you know." And I'm like, okay, you know, I'll just get a little bit hammered. And then, you know, as soon as we leave, I'll just disappear for 3 days and, you know, how it goes. But would still cut that off. And you know, all this time I would, when I did cut it off, here's an interesting little tidbit. When I did cut it off, the obsession would switch to something else, you know. I would switch it to sex. I would switch it to exercise. I would switch it to eating. I would switch it to exercise and eating at the same time, which is freaking bizarre. Overeating while you're training for a marathon, literally. I would switch it to boating, just whatever, man. The flavor of the week, name it. If I could overdo air, I'm pretty sure I'd have done. Just an insatiable desire to fill something up that I didn't know was empty, and I was always chasing the bigger house, the bigger the vacation, traveling all over the world, doing everything insane. Buying houses just to have people over to show them my house. Just motivations completely and wholly driven by fear. And well, that's it. You can just stop right there, driven by fear. And that goes on, until a point where at the point I'm married for 17 years, things are kind of starting to get to where I'm not able to perform that job, and certainly there's no exercising and stuff like that. Been in a while, I'm starting to physically degrade, mentally degrade, and starting to, miss work a little bit and things like this. And I'm just so miserable, so unbelievably miserable, and so horrible to live with that my wife of 17 years, and we were together for 4 or 5 before that. Finally, even though we had two teenage girls, left. She just couldn't take it anymore. She fell in the arms of somebody else, which I can't believe that she stayed with me as long as she did. Of course, until I worked that first real fourth step, I thought it was all her fault, But now it's just, I talked to her today, and I just want to hug that woman, I mean, what an angel for staying with me as long as she did. So when she leaves, and by the way, during that time period, my girls and I, my two daughters and I, are just incredibly close, as close as an alcoholic father can be with their kids. I guess since I was a binge drinker, I did spend a lot of time with them sober, at least clean, not drunk. And I just really, really, really close with both of them. And which is a tragic part of where we're going. But so she leaves. She's like, I think she was basically saying, I'm not gonna watch you kill yourself. That's what you're doing. So she was one of the first ones in my life that did that, and so when she leaves, I have my children with me for a week. And then I have a week to myself, which for a binge drinker with a history of binge drinking and drugging was just the ideal situation. And that's where the end started. That's where the real end started coming. At some point, the binge drinker pushes it to the level you can't stop. There's no stopping at some point. So for about a year, though, I held on to some semblance of normalcy. I did exercise still when they were, around, and did things with them, and didn't get insanely drunk. I don't think I was like completely on the water wagon while they're around, but I wouldn't get insanely drunk, and I wouldn't drink like I want to. My sponsor always says when I controlled it, I didn't enjoy it. When I enjoyed it, I didn't control it. So I would control it when they're around, but I was probably rather miserable when doing so. And then I met the perfect storm. I met a woman that I ended up marrying that was an active drug addict and alcoholic. And that's when drugs started really becoming a big part of my story. And in 3 years, just literally burned everything to the ground. We went on a run that was just Bonnie and Clyde kind. no need in getting into that, but at the, you know, the details of that. But at the end of it, I'm on my way to Georgia because I burned every bridge in Virginia down so bad that I, you know, had to leave the state. Didn't come back for 3 years. And on the way there, I was speaking to my first wife. And I said, I'm going to a rehab in Georgia, and it's 2 years. It's 2 years long, you know. It's a 2 year rehab. And I can't imagine being away from the girls that long. At the time, actually, check that. The conversation was, I'm going to a rehab that's a year long. They had lied to me and not told me that it was 2 years yet because they knew I wouldn't go. So I told her it was a year long because that's what they had told me. And my wife said something to me that that to this day still chills me to the bone. She said, Chris, you may not remember this or know this, but you have gone a year without seeing your daughters. And I lived right down the street from, you know, at the end of my addiction. And I couldn't believe that. You know, I was just floored. And here I was, I didn't want to go to rehab. I'm so self-absorbed. I'm so self-important that I think the world, I don't actively think this, but I must have been thinking that the world will literally stop revolving if I'm not engaged in it, you know. How is anything going to work without me touching stuff, you know? Which really was to my dismay when I got to rehab, and one of the first things they told me was stop touching stuff. So, so I had lost everything. You know, I went to Georgia with a duffel bag, and I had lost my job, my home, my everything, cars. I took my chef's knives that I like to cook, and a cast iron pan because I'm a mountain boy, and you don't get anything more important than that, you know. And one of my little girls. Towels that I used to wrap up when she was a baby. That's literally it. I had to get clothes from the rehab, you know, that I went to. I had to go to a detox for a week just to get into a physical shape that would, you know, that I could even go to a rehab. Go to a rehab, and it was just dialed up for me, you know. God literally dialed this thing up for me. For the person that thinks that the world will stop revolving if they're not in it, to be put in a rehab that you are literally, it is more restrictive at this place than it is if you're in prison. Because if you're in prison, you can have outside contact with your family and friends. You can't hear. You can't have a cell phone. You can't, you can't have a car. You can't leave the campus of the place. Just terrified me at the beginning. I thought, oh my God, what kind of cult is what's happening? But the only job that you can hold is with people in the program that run the program, you know. I had one phone call with my mother after I'd been there for 4.5 months, you know. I had a 10-minute phone call. That was my first contact with the outside world. Much to my dismay. They were doing just fine. In fact, they were doing a lot better off, you know, knowing that they weren't going to get the phone call. Somebody pulled me aside there, you know, realizing, I'm sure having had the same self-absorption, realizing it in me, and pulled me aside and said, guess what? Your kids want you here. You know, they know they're not going to get the call one day that you're no longer with us, you know. So that kind of started me down the road of surrender, you know. I heard Sandy B or somebody talking one time on a speaker tape about surrender. What is surrender? What is this thing that you have to surrender? You know, most people get to AA not on a winning streak and having lost everything, some of us. What else? I don't have anything else to surrender. And he said, well, it's your opinion. It's your judgment. That's really what you have to surrender. Tell a lawyer that. You know, I mean, people come pay me for my opinion, you know, and my judgment, and I'm literally a professional enabler. You know, I do criminal work. I mainly did criminal defense my entire career up until everything crashed, And that's people coming into your office saying, I have screwed all this up. I need you to fix it for me. And I'm like, cool. Don't change anything about yourself. I'll fix it for you. You know? Worst case scenario when it comes to, you know, being me. So I spend about a month, you know, there's a biblical tale about wrestling with God. Jacob wrestling with God, Jacob wrestling with God. And that's what I did. You know, that's where the journey began for me because I just couldn't come to grips with the fact that if I wasn't involved, was just talking to a sponsee about this either yesterday or the day before about how I felt like I didn't know it, but I felt like my family was were chattel. They're my possessions. They are mine to protect. They are mine to dictate to, I guess. They just won't make it without, you know. I'm an unbelievably self-absorbed prig, you know. But I didn't know that. I thought that I was just altruistic, you know. I'm such a martyr. I sacrifice myself, you know, for them. They don't appreciate it. I don't know any of this stuff, you know, but these are the things that I'm wrestling with that you tell me I gotta stop touching stuff. All right. Okay. I seems like lately everything I touch has been turning anyway, so maybe I'll try your method, you know. It can't get worse than it is now. Outside of prison, there wasn't a consequence that I didn't enjoy, that didn't teach me a lesson. Slept on the street, slept in the woods, you know, just about everything. So I start for the first time earnestly seeking this thing. The big book says it's put the purpose of the program is to put us in contact with, you know, a little bit, I guess, part of the story that I should, go into a little bit is I was raised Southern Baptist, very evangelical, hellfire, you know, brimstone preaching. And while I always believed in that God, the Christian God, I couldn't come to terms with a lot of the concepts that came out of the evangelical views. I thought about going into theology. You know, I like to sit around thinking about stuff, which is another great thing for an addict to do. You know, and reading and going into the history and biblical history and theology is still one of my passions. I read the Bible a couple times before I was 16, you know. But I just couldn't, it just didn't make sense, man. You know, a lot of it. So while I'm wrestling with God, I'm wrestling with those notions and those things that I have been taught about God being the judging, punishing, you know. I've since learned that if you don't have the best, if you have a father wound, your vision of God may be a little skewed from maybe where it should be. Obviously, I have one of those. So I can look back now and see maybe where some of that came from. But I started wrestling with it a lot, and finally, after about a month, came away with a limp like Jacob did. But I, you know, I made it out of that and started going, okay, I'm going to try this thing. You know, during that time, I wanted to die so bad when I got there. I spent a lot of time trying to die, and I just couldn't. That's when I decided to get sober, was when I tried and tried and tried and couldn't die. Alcohol and drugs didn't work anymore. You people were the only thing left. Thank God for that. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna try this thing. I had gone to rehab before this. This was not my first rehab, and spent some time in the rooms. In fact, I spent time in the room that I am, that is my home group now, Suffer Enough. But I didn't do the things I was supposed to do and went back out. But I did have a good notion of what the program looked like and what you should do. I had a really good sponsor, And I just didn't do the things, you know, I hadn't surrendered. So at that point, I get there, I've lost my kids, who I adore and have always been so incredibly close to. I've lost my wife, lost all the material possessions, which don't really matter. And I meet a guy who had done the same thing. He had two young kids. Mine were teenagers at the time. And he'd been doing this thing for about a year and a half at the time. And we were sitting around a campfire at my first meeting. Mind you, I like to kick alcohol and benzos at the same time, which are the two worst things you could possibly kick. So that's going on. So I had been in detox for a week. They're literally injecting me intravenously with Ativan to keep me from seizing because I have real bad seizures when I'm coming off. But I'm still shaking so bad that they're scared. You know, the guy that is running the house that I get to is like, "Oh God, what are you doing to me? I'm getting ready to leave this place, and you're sending me somebody that may croak at any second." So I'm sitting out, you know, at the campfire, my first meeting at this place, and I'm shaking so bad I can barely sit on the stump that I'm on. And this laughter rings out, and I start noticing that the person that has lost his kids and came from prison to this place. This rehab was a real last gasper's place. You know, it was prison or dying or both is when you got in. If you didn't have that, you didn't get in to this place. They didn't take you. So he had come from prison. He had lost his kids, done a prison stint, lost everything. And, you know, he had something that I wanted because he was full of what I had been looking for my entire life, you know? And that's where the hope, I had to work up to the desperation everybody talks about, right? Because I just wanted to die. Yeah, just give up. I had given up a long time ago. I just couldn't go. So I had to work up to find the desperation to do the things to find the hope. You know, and hearing his laughter is literally saved my life. You know, we had a meeting just a couple weeks ago, and it was on hope and how coming into the rooms the first time, a lot of people will tell you, and my story hinges on that hope that you get, that you guys give me every time I walk into a room, the first time I went in there. And this guy's laughter literally saved me. Because I thought if he can come from prison after losing everything, then I can do this thing too. Maybe I can do this thing too. Still wasn't convinced by any means. But I thought at least, you know what? I'll give it a try. I'll give it a shot. I don't know if I'll get it right. And I don't think it'll even work on me. You know, I'm still terminally unique. You don't have my story. You don't have my problems. You don't have my thoughts. You don't have my history. So I'm still not convinced it's going to work, but I'll give it a shot, you know. And started doing the stuff, started working the steps, and haven't looked back. Well, maybe a couple times, just briefly. But, you know, that's where miracle started, you know. And I could spend the next 4 days trying to explain those miracles, but you guys, a lot of you have lived them, you know, your own version of them. But when I got there, I didn't want to stay at the rehab, you know. When I had to leave, I didn't want to go. You know, I had 5.5 months there, and I had to do some grueling physical labor to be able to stay there. The only job you could do is a sprinkler fitter, fire suppression systems, you know, hanging them in warehouses, 20-foot steel pipe. And I'm 45 years old at the time, killing myself physically because I'm still a people pleaser. And I end up hurting my back and I can't do that work. So, you know, they don't have any choice but to, you know, let me out on a medical leave to try to get some help and, come back. But I had pretty much resigned myself to the fact that if I made it, on the outside, that I wasn't going to come back there. Unless I was told by, something bigger than me. So I left there terrified out of my skull. And thus began a journey that's is kind of unique, frankly. It was either I burned all my bridges. I got a lot of family down there. That's, where I'm from. And but I had burned all my bridges to the point where, I only had one family member that I could stay that would let me stay with her. And she is an active drug addict at the time. Not too many people would recommend you live in such a situation, upon getting out of rehab and trying to actually get sober. But it was either that or be on the street. And I figured if I was on the street, I would have less of a chance of staying sober on the street than I would if I stayed there. So I began. Martin Luther King Jr., one of his famous sayings was, forgiveness is not an occasional act. It's a way of life. It's a way of living. It's a way of, thinking and behaving. Thus began my journey to learn that, because when you live with an active addict and you're like, I was sitting there like, God, I'm finally doing this thing, I'm finally doing this thing. And this is the situation that you've put me in, I was just like, I couldn't believe it because the chaos, it's just pure chaos. 6 o'clock in the morning, until whenever you go to bed at that night, you're dealing with the chaos. And so I was resentful that I had to deal with that chaos, even though I wasn't the one causing it for a change, So I did my inventories. I did my nightly inventories. I did them 7 times a day, The little toolkit app, the AA toolkit app saved my life. I can look back at it and see the pattern, and see when I started to finally get it. Because I would do my nightly inventory and I would let go of the resentments that I had developed that day from the chaos that was happening around me. It's just 6 o'clock in the morning, they would start over, and I'm living in that again. At some point, not only was I living there, but I was working with this person as well. So it was, and then my sponsor, as soon as we got through the steps, he told me that I had to, well, he made a suggestion that I go start doing volunteer work at a recovery house. So in my working life, in my home life, and in my off time, literally immersed in addiction. Which was just exactly what I needed. I just hated the fact that I was living in that environment. Incidentally, go back a little bit. And when I got out of rehab, I was searching in the area that I was in, which was a kind of a rural area, not many meetings around for a sponsor, because I knew that I needed to do these steps that you guys were telling me to even have a chance. So I just buried myself like a tick in the recovery community. Incidentally, I've moved about 8 times since getting sober, and every time, sometimes different states, every time that's the first thing I do. I don't care about work. I don't care about anything social. I don't care about, heck, when I moved back up here, I didn't even care about where I was living. I didn't even have a place to live. Didn't care. I had a sponsor before I got here. If you're going to move somewhere, I highly recommend just burying yourself like a tick in the community, because that's what you need first and foremost, and, above all else. So I found a sponsor, worked those steps, jumped into the recovery community, all the while living in a very toxic environment. I would go and pick up morphine from the drugstore for this person. And just seems like the last damn thing you should be doing, but I didn't have a choice. I mean, I guess I did if I lived on the street or whatever. So I'm there for about a year and a half, 2 years, and an opportunity presents us. And I finally get to a place, by the way, to where I'm living in that forgiveness, to where I don't form those resentments. thoughts anymore. I actually feel empathy and feel gratitude that I don't live. It's a perfect example. It's just a perfect example every day that I'm staring at, that look at what you don't have to live like anymore. Look at what God has given you. You know, one of my favorite things to say is look at, come and see what God has done, you know? And so I get to that place and, you know, to where I'm not living in resentment, I'm living in sympathy and empathy and love, which is just crazy for me to even say, for me to do that, for God to get me in that place. And I have an opportunity finally to leave, you know. I had been begging for that the entire time. And through miracle after miracle, it wasn't money or a job or anything else that got me there. My sponsor came to me and said, I'm going to walk the Appalachian Trail, the whole one, the whole thing. It's going to take me 6 months, and I want you to take care of my house. I'm like, I don't have any money. I can't pay rent. You know, the reason I'm living with this person is because I don't have to pay rent. And he's like, I don't need you. Just take care of my house. You know, the miracle started then. So I'm there for that 6 months. I didn't even apply to get my law license back, by the way, for a couple of years. I just like, because I had to surrender the dang thing because under what's called an impairment disability, which means basically that you're so drunk and so drugged up that you can't freaking practice law. You're not fit. You know, you're not fit. So, you know, I'm like, cool, agreed, surrender my license. Well, how do you come out of that? How do you get your license back? You have to prove that you're not, that you're fit again, right? Well, only time is going to do that. Time. And I was engaged. I didn't have a clue how much stuff my sponsor got me into or suggested that I do until I had to get together a little package for the bar and put it, you know, say, this is what I've been doing, you know, since I burned everything down and you guys were chasing me around. Incidentally, when I applied to get my license back, there's an investigator that gets appointed to your case. Well, she was the same investigator that was chasing my ass around Richmond at the end when I burned everything down. And the first thing I did was like, oh my God, I owe you an amends. I wasted so much of your time, you know? Tell me my God doesn't have a sense of humor, right? So, I apply to get my license back and am able to do that during that 6 months that he's gone. And then I'm keeping my eyes open the whole time I'm in Georgia trying to. Am I supposed to stay here? You know, what am I supposed to do? You know, where am I supposed to go? How am I supposed to do it? And nothing pointed towards staying there. It just never did. So at some point after I got my license back, though, I had no money. I strapped the smallest U-Haul trailer that you can rent to the back of my beat-up truck that my mom had bought me, you know, and moved back up here or moved back to Richmond. I didn't have a place to live. My credit was so bad that I couldn't even rent an apartment, you know. So I was staying in an Airbnb, and I had contacted a couple of guys about renting a room in their house. And 2 days after I got here, one of them called me and said, my roommate's moving out. The place is going to be available in 2 weeks. So I go meet with him, and he says, yeah, my roommate, you know, I've had him for a year. He's a great guy. He's moving out. He's a recovering alcoholic. And he's, you know, gotten himself together enough to where he's going to be able to get his own place. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Because, you know, you're collecting us, apparently. And, you know, so I move in with him. The whole time I'm doing what in the legal profession, frankly, is what people like me do when you get back in the legal profession, which is document review, it's called. And you just sit online and point and click at documents all day long for hours and hours and hours for not much money. And exploring avenue after avenue, you know, about where to go, what to do, and how to do it. And working the program up here just as hard, if not harder, than anywhere else that I had been. I immediately got myself in a service position, you know, just started doing all the things that we're supposed to do. Ended up meeting my now wife, and then things started falling into place to where I knew that moving up here with $400 to my name, by the way, no job, no place to live, no real plan, was the right thing, you know, because at some point, it takes some of us a little while to get there, and some of us not so much, but things just start aligning. You guys know if you've been in it for in sobriety for any amount of time, things just, you're like, oh, okay, now, okay, well, that makes sense, right? And then it has been a literal whirlwind, an actual whirlwind since then. I met who's now my wife, end up moving up in with her. Miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle. You know, it just I all during this time, this how God how my higher power works. All during this time, I'm applying to I don't know how many jobs, but it's hundreds, you know, and not getting any traction, not really thinking that this whole document review is gonna hopefully not be my future, and none of it ever works. And I'm like, ah, you know, and you get pushed to that point where we're having, okay, you know, you're nice and serene now. I felt like sometimes God was that you've seen somebody tie or put $100 bill on the floor with a fishing line on it. Somebody reached down and you just yank it. I felt like God was doing that to me, you know, okay, well, maybe this is the way I'm supposed to go. And then that opportunity or whatever, that direction would get yanked right out from under me. And I felt like I was like, okay, you found serenity. What about now? You know, how about now? Yanking that $100 bill out from under me. And I would find it again, you know, sometimes not as quickly as I should or I would like, but I would work the program like I'm supposed to work it. And finally, at some point, it just was like getting on a roller coaster. You can't make this stuff up, you know. I get married. Instead of one of those 300 jobs that I've applied to working out, some guy just calls, no, texts me on Messenger, Facebook Messenger, and says, I need somebody to help me with such and such. Not really worth getting into the details, but boom, right there, I go meet with him. That's some guaranteed income, you know, not a lot, but enough to stop doing what I was doing and like maybe get a little traction. Starting my own practice back up. And my mentor, who I had been practiced with for 20 years, loses his law license and starts referring a bunch of cases to me. I mean, God will give you some stuff in some weird ways, you know. You know, and then all these things start happening to the point where now, you know, my wife is an optometrist, and we had to get her license back too. I went and represented her at her hearing, which was freaking. I wasn't nervous until I got in there and she's there, and then they start firing questions at her, which normally is my element, you know, but I just about crap myself. So we got her license back and just recently moved. And we have an AA community that when we were moving, it is so strong. And I feel, you know, I had been in that community and I crapped all over it. Now I see people come in the room now and get handed a literally tailored, hand-tailored gift from God for their particular situation. And they just, you know, they're not ready yet. And I did that. So I was just praying that the home group that I was in was still anything like it was before, and it feels even stronger. It's probably because I'm a little stronger. But when we were moving, I was like, "There's no way you're not." There's one condition I have, and that's that we're not moving far away from here. That, not even to the West End. I don't even want it to take 20 minutes to get here. We lived 5 minutes south of my home group, and now we live 5 minutes north. Not kidding. I one of those people that I mentioned earlier about leaving me because they weren't going to watch me kill myself was my assistant, my legal assistant. She, shoot, man, 2 or 3 years before I really burned everything down, she didn't even see the real ugly parts. She was just like, "I'm not going to watch this happen." She took a lot for her, knowing her now. It just took a lot for her to do, and I know that it caused her all kinds of pain and trouble. I just hired her back, and she hugged me so hard. We just moved offices too, and she hugged me so hard on Friday that I think she was kind of like, I met with one of my former law partners that I had practiced with for about 20 years and owed her a huge amends. She got me into one of the detoxes that I literally at MCB left and went straight to the liquor store, after she had just, she's watching me die too. So I meet with her and make my amends, and we're just supposed to be having lunch. She, incidentally, was my first wife's sister. And we had always been really close, and I met with her, and we were supposed to just have lunch. And I think 3 hours later, we leave the little pizza restaurant where we had met, and 2 days later, she texted me and probably gave me the best compliment I've had since I got sober, which was, "Can regular people do AA?" I guess she had seen such an incredible change in me. It's common saying that people don't change. Well, I see it happen in this program. People that I see walk in the program, and I smell misery and vodka on their breath the first day. I've watched them transform into literally different people. And people watch me do the same thing. You can't see it in yourself as much, but just like I said, miracle after miracle. My mother, God bless her, what an incredible saint. When I was 9 years old, she had her husband, my father, kill himself in an alcoholic death and watched me walk through every step that he did except pull the trigger. But she also watched me walk through every step to get sober. She, when I first got out of rehab, she made me call her every day. She was one of the people that lived in Georgia, but wouldn't let me live with her. She's like, "You're gonna have to prove yourself before you come anywhere around here." And she made me call her every day, and to this day, I don't call her every day, but I text with her every day. Morning. She's one of the first things I do in the morning is text her good morning. And one of the last things I do at night is text her good night. And she has got to watch me walk this journey, which, I keep a chip on my mantle that has my father's firefighter tag, name tag on it. And that's his chip, that he was never able to get. I've given her every one of my chips since then. Every time I see her, it's the first thing I do. If I got a new one, is give her that and press it in her hand. And I don't think I've ever seen a happier, more relieved human being in the world than she is at my sobriety. I could literally go on and on and on. When they say in the book that meeting newcomers and meeting each other at these meetings are the, I always stress, the bright spot of our lives. It's true. You know, I know none of you except one who wrote up here with me, but I know every one of you, you know, and you know me. And that's one of the most amazing things about this program is though I have moved and moved and moved so many times, I literally had a community that supports me, expecting nothing. You know, all I had to do was show up, suit up and show up. That's what I did today. Thanks for paying attention to my ranting.
Yeah.